Okay, thank you very much. So let me start by thanking the organizers. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a great place, and it's a pleasure to be back. We have had a rather wide variety of talks, maybe with the unifying element of a broad distribution of relaxation rates or energy scales. And this will also be the item that connects this talk to the overall theme of the workshop. So I will be talking about superconductivity, or specifically the transition to superconductivity in nanowires, in ultra-thin nanowires. And we will see that close to the superconducting transitions in these wires, we again get a very broad distribution, an extremely broad distribution, actually, of energy scales. And correspondingly of time scales. And so this is work done in collaboration with my former postdoc, José Hoyos, who is now back in Brazil in a faculty position in Sao Paulo, and with Adrian Del Maestro, who's just now moving from British Columbia to Baltimore, and Bernd Rosenau from Germany. Okay, so here's the outline. I will start by giving a brief motivation by talking about the experiments and superconducting nanowires. And then I will focus on the question of the transition between metallic wires and superconducting wires that occurs there as a function of wire thickness, actually. And we will derive an order parameter theory for this transition. And in the first main part of the talk, I will just explore the thermodynamics of this transition, applying a strong disorder renormalization group, which is very similar in spirit to the one Amir talked about in his talk last week, right? And we will see that we get a very unusual type of phase transition, and we will at that point we will identify this very broad distribution of energy scales, which also leads to a very broad distribution of time scales. And in the last part, I will come back to the actual nanowires, and we will see what consequences this very broad distribution of energy scales has for one interesting measurable quantity. So I will talk about results for the AC conductivity. Okay, and so the first part about the thermodynamics has been already published in these two papers, and the last part is in this preprint. Okay, so let's start looking at experiments. These experiments are, the oldest ones are about 10 years old, and they have been performed, for instance, in the group of Alexei Bezryadin in Urbana-Champaign. And so the idea is to produce an extremely thin nanowire that can be made superconducting. And they use a very ingenious technique, so they etch a trench in a semiconductor structure by conventional means, and then they place a carbon nanotube across the trench, right? So it's supported here and here, but it's freestanding in the middle, right? And then after they have placed one or a few of these carbon nanotubes across the trench, they actually deposit superconducting material from the top. And so you get a layer of superconductivity here and here, and the superconducting material also partially covers the nanotube, and then it forms a thin superconducting wire across the trench. And here's a micrograph of an actual example. So it's a few hundred nanometers long, and the typical widths are between 5 and 15 nanometers or something like this. Right, the effective widths of the superconducting material here. Okay, so now let's look at what happens if you try to measure resistivity. And this is one of the experimental plots for several of these wires. And you see they all have a first big drop in resistance. And this is due to the superconducting transition in the leads, right? So these are molybdenum germanium films in this case, and they go superconducting at a temperature not too far below the bulk superconducting temperature of molybdenum germanium, which, if I remember correctly, is 6 point something Kelvin. Okay, But then you see there's two different kinds of wires. There's the ones that are shown in black here, and they remain resistive to the lowest measurable temperatures of about 1 Kelvin here. And there's a second set of wires that have a second drop in resistivity, which is interpreted as the superconducting transition in the wire. Okay? So it turns out that there is a relation between the wire thickness and the and where they are in this plot. It's not a strict proportionality, but the thicker wires tend to be up here, and the thinner wires tend to be down here. And so therefore, in an abstract way, what we have here, of course, is now a quantum phase transition, a zero temperature phase transition between a superconductor and a metal as a function of wire thickness, that we need to understand, right? So these are supposed to be superconducting at zero temperature. These remain metallic at zero temperature. So we have a quantum phase transition as a function of thickness between these two states.
Did you say that the thicker wires on top?
The thinner wires remain metallic. Sorry about that. The thinner wires, as written here, so this is correct. The thinner wires remain metallic. The thicker wires go superconducting, right? Okay. Before I go on, let me also point out that there is...
Is it that they're superconducting, or is that they become a good weak link junction?
Well, they are, of course, of finite length, right? And if they were infinitely long, then, of course, they could not be superconducting, because we know there cannot be any true long-range order in one dimension, right? But since they are of finite length, right?
I'm asking whether you know that the wire itself is superconducting, or the wire is simply able to carry the phase information between the two larger superconductors.
Well, you are thinking in terms of a single Josephson junction or something like this, right?
Like,
but I think it's probably too long, right? To
the question if it's longer or shorter than the coherence length of the electrons.
Right. Okay. So that's a good point. Then we'll come back to this. So it's longer than the coherence length, right? It's longer than the coherence length. We'll come back to that. Okay. Before I go on, let me also point out that there is some controversy in the literature about the actual nature of this transition, in the sense that it's controversially discussed whether this state up here for the thin wires should be treated as a metal or as an insulator, right? Some people interpret this transition as a transition between a superconductor and an insulator driven by phase fluctuations, very similar to what's done in thin films. I could add a few more curves up here that actually show upturns at low temperatures. I don't want to get too much into this controversy, except for pointing out on the next slide that there is strong indications that there is pair breaking going on, probably due to surface magnetic impurities, which would then put this into the pair breaking type of superconductor to metal transition. And maybe even thinner wires do become insulating at lower temperatures, but this would not be relevant for the transition we are looking at. And so here is some experimental evidence for actual magnetic impurities, which are supposed to be random impurities on the surface. So these are experimental data that show what happens if you apply a magnetic field. So this shows critical current versus magnetic field, right? And of course, the naive expectation would be that it just goes down, right? Because magnetic field would destroy superconductivity. But as you see here, for various wires, initially it always goes up, right? So that means initially a weak field appears to enhance superconductivity, right? So the critical current goes up. And this is interpreted as the weak magnetic field actually aligning the surface magnetic impurities, therefore reducing the magnetic scattering and enhancing superconductivity. And if you look at the picture here, the solid lines going through the data are actual fits to a theory developed by Paul Goldbart and Nayana Shaw and co-workers to model this effect and to show that indeed, if we have random magnetic materials on the surface, you would expect such a behavior. So I take this.
How is it possible that this effect actually is bigger than direct suppression of superconductivity by external magnetic field?
I don't really know. As I said, I don't.
It is in principle possible if there are no spin orbit and you put a parallel field to a thin field.
Even in this case.
I
really don't want to go into this discussion. I want to take it as a starting point and ask what happens to a superconductor metal transition in such a wire if it's of the pair breaking kind, right? So I just assume there's some pair breaker, could be this, that gives me a pair breaking superconductor metal transition, okay? So now we need to go ahead and describe this transition. And what I want to do is I want to derive an order parameter field theory. And before this, we first need to talk a little bit about length scales. As I said, the wires are about 10 nanometers thick and a few hundred nanometers long, right? And it's important to realize that at the thickness of about 10 nanometers, these are not really one-dimensional from the point of view of normal electrons, because there are still a large number of transverse channels, right? So therefore, the motion of the unpaired electrons is effectively three-dimensional. However, the width of the wire is less than the coherence length, not the length, but the width, right? The width is less than the coherence length, and therefore the superconducting fluctuations should be considered one-dimensional. So what we have here is one-dimensional superconducting fluctuations coupled to a Fermi liquid, right? So this is not a problem of a Lattinger liquid in the one-dimensional electrons, because we have still a rather large wire. This is a problem of a Fermi liquid. Okay, and actually, if you do this, you can work out the pair propagator for the Cooper pairs, and this has been done in this paper. For instance. And then you observe such a propagator. And the crucial point here is that.
I'm sorry, what is Q?
Q is the wave number, right?
No, it's a bit strange. It depends on both distance.
R is the distance from criticality. Right.
So it's usually
it's not a spatial distance. So R is not a distance in real space. R is let's say wire thickness minus critical wire thickness or something like this.
So it's usual Cooper pair propagator.
Yes.
Above DC.
Right. But remember, I'm doing a zero temperature theory here. Right. So this is a zero temperature theory. I'm trying to talk about the zero temperature transition. So far, the propagator is whatever it is, and I've written about the Subara frequency here, so it could be finite temperature or zero temperature, doesn't matter.
But where this formula comes from? Can you comment? Is it derived or is it just?
Yes, it's derived.
How?
Effectively, it's just the. It's just the bubble, right? In the presence of a pair breaker.
Yeah, but then how you introduce R?
No, yeah.
In the bubble. If you will, instead of attraction, put repulsion, then this is not correct because it is. It will be.
No, of course, but we know the wires want to go superconducting, right? So we know there is some effective attraction.
That's my question: is it postulated or is it derived?
It's derived, right? You can derive it from a standard. Oh, okay.
Standard? How you introduce R into standard when in standard there is no criticality, unless you have transition from attraction to repulsion.
No, you have a pair breaker, right? The R comes from the pair breaking
and gamma.
And gamma is just the prefactor of the
so
lambda damping term.
R is due to magnetic impurities.
Yeah, or whatever pair breaker you want, right? Maybe if you want magnetic impurities, right? It's clear without a pair breaker, you would not get
magnetic impurities. Then you should refer on the precaution of Kirchhoff, not on this paper. I mean, this isn't.
It's the same physics as Aprikosov-Gorkov. I think these people did it specifically with having these nanowires in mind, right?
Where is the specifics of nanowires?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So just to avoid confusion for all the others, this R is not real space, right? This is not a real space distance. This is the distance from criticality, right? The wire thickness minus critical thickness times some number value factor. Okay, and so once we have this, of course, we can now go ahead and write down an order parameter field theory. And this was actually done not by us, but it was done first, for all I know, for this problem by Sachdev and co-workers in 2004, who wrote down the order parameter field theory for the clean theory, right? So they neglected all effects of disorder, assumed a clean theory with the propagator I just wrote down, and then you get something like this, right? So it's a standard Phi-4 theory. This is the inverse propagator that we just saw. This is a conventional fourth order term, and Phi would, in our case now, be representing the Cooper pair operator, right?
And there is no fermionic degrees of freedom.
No, they have been integrated out, right? Using a standard procedure like Haber-Zatanovich transformation and integrating out the fermions. And this leads to this formulation.
Isn't it equivalent to time-dependent
Gisbert-Mandel? At finite temperatures, if you would look at the finite temperature transition, then you could say this is time-dependent.
But this is incorrect, unless you are in this gapless superconductivity regime with magnetic impurities.
But I am, this is a pair-breaking inequality class, right? Okay, so this is the order parameter field theory, and our step was adding disorder. And at the level of the field theory, that means that all the coefficients in the field theory, in particular the distance from criticality, the bare coherence lengths, the dissipation constant, they can all be functions of the position along the wire, right? And this order would come, as I pointed out, from the random positions of the pair breaking strengths and random positions of magnetic impurities, for instance, on the wire. And let me note in passing that this has the same functional form as the order parameter field theory that occurs for itinerant quantum magnets. This has been derived using the same methods in the mid-70s by Hertz for the case of a quantum interferomagnet, a metallic quantum interferomagnet. The only difference, of course, being that dimensionality would be 3 in this case, and you would have 3 order parameter components, right? Full spin rotation invariance, whereas here you have only one dimension and U1 symmetry.
So without the gamma term, the standards are kind of critical point phenomenon. So now, what's the origin of gamma in Hertz's theory?
The order parameter couples to particle hole degrees of freedom, so order parameter fluctuations can decay into particle hole excitations, which are gapless, right? And let me again point out, this is the theory that I want to apply to the zero temperature quantum phase transition, right? So therefore, it's important that we keep the frequency degrees of freedom. Okay, so now the question is what happens with such a quantum phase transition if we have both disorder and also coupling to the electrons, and I'm using dissipation in the sense of Caldera-Leggett. I'm going to describe a zero temperature theory. So after the discussion yesterday, it's probably worth pointing this out. And so the way we want to approach this problem is we want to apply the so-called strong disorder renormalization group, which is a method that actually makes use of the disorder to simplify the solution. Okay, and so this is a real-spaced based method. And so therefore, the first thing we are doing is we are discretizing the field theory in space by introducing what you may want to call rotor variables that represent the superconducting fluctuations in some volume. That is, it's not a microscopic variable. So it's a mesoscopic volume, and phi is this rotor variable represents the field in this cell, right? And if we do this, then we get a discrete field theory. So these are the rotor variables. The local part remains unchanged. And instead of the gradient squared in the field theory, I just get a nearest neighbor coupling between nearest neighbors, or nearest neighbor rotors along the chain. And let me also point out that for technical reasons, I will first look at the field theory in the large n limit. So it takes the limit of an infinite number of order parameter components instead of just two.
This is a Gaussian limit. What happened to the fourth order term?
I'm just commenting on that. Give me two sentences more. So I'm working in the large n limit. What this buys me is that actually, instead of having a fourth order term, I get a constraint for the length that I can implement by a Lagrange multiplier. So I get a self-consistent Gaussian theory, right? And of course, I have to show, and I will show in the end, that the results will remain the same for two-order parameter components. Okay. So now we need to treat this action, and this is where the minimalization group comes into play. This is a method that was first applied to Heisenberg spins by Matas, Gupta, and Hu in the late 70s, and later fully developed by Daniel Fisher in the mid-90s, who solved the quantum phase transition in the random transverse field Ising chain with this method. Okay, and this method becomes asymptotically exact if the disorder becomes broad, right? So the basic idea of this method is that we identify local high energy degrees of freedom and integrate them out. So how would that work in our system here? So looking at this, we see there's two competing energies in the problem, right? There is the J's, which you may want to call Josephson couplings between grains, if you want an intuitive picture. And then there's these epsilons, which I want to call gaps, keeping in mind that there are no real gaps because due to the electrons, of course, system is gapless, but there are characteristic energies that tell you how far you are from criticality, right? But gap is a nice short word, so I want to call them gaps. So you have the couplings and the gaps, and it's clear that the couplings, they prefer long-range order, whereas the gaps, they prefer to the metallic phase. That means whenever epsilon is large, then this grain will not be close to the superconductivity, whereas if I have couplings, if I have a large J between two grains, then their phases will be locked. And so now the RG proceeds in the following. In each step, I identify the largest of these scales locally, and if the distributions are broad, which I assume for the moment, then of course, locally, the term with the largest overall energy will dominate over all the others, and I can apply perturbation theory to integrate it out.
Let me ask again, just maybe emphasize one thing. So you are now integrating high energy degrees of freedom down to low energy.
Right.
At the same time, fermionic degrees of freedom, you integrate it in spite of the fact that you don't have a gap and there are all energies of them. Is
right.
It consistent or not?
This is a very good philosophical question that applies.
It's not philosophical, sorry.
That applies, of course, to all phi-4 theory, Hertz-type theory approaches to phase transition metals, right?
Because all these theories are garbage.
You always integrate out the fermions first, and the question is...
No, there is thinking space consideration of transition between superconductor and metal. And it's just entirely due to fermionic degrees of freedom. You don't need any magnetic impurities or whatever you want. And it's consistent because it happens at only at small amount of zero.
Now, but these, wait a second, these are two different remarks, right? One is a remark about the validity of Hertz's approach to the theory that I started from, the theory where you have a pair-breaking superconductor metal transition, right? And this is a valid question in the sense that in all these cases, one has to ask what is the feedback of the order of fluctuations in the fermions, and in some cases, it has been shown to be wrong, right? But your second remark, of course, you said I don't need a pair breaker, but that would be a different theory, right?
No. Pair breaking or not pair breaking, you mean a violation of key invariance, is another story. What I want to tell is that fermionic degrees of freedom are crucial near the transition to metal. And in this approach, they are thrown away without any justification, unless I misunderstand something.
Well, I would not say they are. I don't think you can say they are thrown away, right? They are integrated out, and if I could treat this, the resulting theory exactly, then of course I would capture the full physics.
No,
I cannot do this.
There is Finkelstein's theory calculation based on the BCS and shows that they are crucial. How you can exactly integrate them out?
Well, as I said, if I could integrate them out exactly, and then I they would not be thrown away, right?
Continue.
Okay, so this is a procedure.
Would you do with the
gamma? Well, actually, within this large N theory, the gammas and the epsilons are not independent, right? So they go along with the with the epsilons. There is a relation that couples the local gamma to the local epsilons. So they are not an independent scale. Okay, so let's look what happens if I do this. There's two cases, right? The largest energy could be a gap, or the largest energy could be a bond. If the largest energy is a gap, that means this grain can be integrated out. So we can throw it out of the system, but of course, if we would just simply throw it out, then the chain would be broken. So we need to calculate the effective coupling between the neighbors in perturbation theory. And this can be done straightforwardly. And the resulting structure for the new coupling, J tilde that couples these two after I've integrated this one out, is just JJ over epsilon. So it's exactly the structure that you would expect from second order perturbation theory, right? The large energy scale is in the denominator, and then the two matrix elements are up there. Okay? So you generate a new bond that is here of this form, and it's important to point out that this new J tilde is, of course, much smaller than the J's that you had before, because by construction, epsilon was the largest energy in the system, right? So these are much smaller, and so the J tilde is then smaller than any of the J's that were involved in this step. Alternatively, if the J is large, we want to replace this the two grains by one, and then you need to calculate the effective distance from criticality, the effective gap for the new grain, and this is actually a non-trivial step that does not follow simply from perturbation theory, but it turns out that for the form of the action of the field theory that we have, with a linear infrequency term, the damping term coming from the electrons, we also get the multiplicative structure. So the new epsilon is epsilon over J. Okay? So these are the two recursion relations. And now we iterate this over and over again until we reduce the energy down as far as we want. And you could do this on the computer if you wanted to. But you can also do it analytically in one dimension, because in each step, the epsilons and j's remain independent, and therefore you can formulate this procedure in terms of distribution functions for the j's, p of j, and r of epsilon. And these, you get flow equations for these distributions that take this form, and I'm not talking about them in detail, except pointing out that these flow equations are identical to those of the random transverse field Ising chain that they are derived by Daniel Fisher in the mid-90s. So we arrive at the same flow equations, and of course, consequently, we arrive at the same flow, and that also means we arrive at the same fixed points. So from a pure critical phenomena point of view, we could stop here. We could say our transition is in the same universality class as Fisher's random transverse fieldizing chain. And let me point out that this is somewhat surprising, maybe, because the symmetries of the problem are very different, right? So the transverse fieldizing chain has a discrete symmetry, whereas we have a continuous symmetry. And in the transverse fieldizing chain, there's no metallic degrees of freedom, no damping. Whereas here, we have the linear and frequency term that describes the lambda damping.
Can you explain again how the lambda is related to the epsilon? Seems to be quite crucial.
I don't think it's crucial. And I will come back to why it's not crucial. So let me just make one remark, and we can maybe talk about the technical part later on. So if you just look at one grain, right, and the action is just this, right? But we have the large N constraint, which fixes the length of this phi, right? And if you just self-consistently calculate what epsilon has to be to fulfill the length constraint, you see that epsilon and gamma are actually related. They are forced to be related by the length constraint. So that's technically, it's a result of the large N limit. And again, as I will show later on, this is not important for what's going to come. Okay, so this is the result. Now let's talk about the resulting phase transition scenario qualitatively. So I'm not discussing these solutions of these equations in mathematical terms, but let's talk about them physically. So let's look at this picture over here that describes how the initial distributions, before you start this RG procedure, for the gaps and the couplings may have looked like, right? And there's five cases that I want to discuss. Let's start maybe with this case here.
I'm not sure whether I will add something to computer. I'd like to make a comment against this expansion, this Landau expansion at zero temperature. The point is that we were speaking about individual superconducting grains, which for some reason survive. In framework of this section, susceptibility of this grain grows exponential with the length or with the volume in general. And as a result, some rare and rare grains become more and more important. However, there is a maximum, maximum data which you can achieve. And actually what happens is that very soon your grains become, say delta becomes so forth equal to delta naught. It means that Andreev reflection takes place. It means that actually susceptibility doesn't grow anymore proportional to exponent of the volume. And how it is incorporated in the interesting picture, I'm not sure, but I actually agree that this Ginzburg-Landau expansion breaks very quickly, as opposed to classical phase transitions, where of course it is very basic thing. So here, basically, this Ginzburg-Landau expansion at zero temperature never works.
There's an upper cutoff, right, for the gap. Yes, sure.
Okay. Yeah. As a result, susceptibility of the grain which you're speaking doesn't grow exponentially with the volume of the grain. So all this procedure stops. And there is no Griffith phase now.
Once it grows beyond that upper cutoff.
I'm saying that zero temperature, it is the case. Whether this makes sense in intermediate temperatures, I don't know.
Okay, so let's look at these five possible cases. If in the beginning all the epsilons are larger than all the j's, then during the RG procedure you will only eliminate grains, right? Because all the epsilons are always larger than the j, so whatever you always pick an epsilon and eliminate the grain, right? So in the end, nothing is left, and this gives you the conventional disordered, in our language, metallic phase, right? Conversely, if all the j's are larger than all the epsilons, then you do the opposite, right? You never throw anything out. You always fuse them together, and you end up with a superconducting phase. So these are the two conventional phases. The more interesting cases are these two, where the epsilons are, on average, larger than the j's, but there's some overlap. Then you are still in the disordered phase here, but there is some probability due to this overlap that you form a large, especially large region where a large cluster grows. So you have a large clusters, large ordered clusters embedded in an overall disordered system. And here it's the other way around. Your system is overall ordered, but there could be large disordered regions embedded in the ordered region. And so this would be the two Griffiths phases. And of course, in between is the actual critical point. If the two are identical in the beginning, or strictly what you need is that the average of log epsilon is the same as log j, then cluster aggregation and elimination just balance, and you are the critical point, right? OK, so this is the overall structure of the phases. And it's interesting to look at the actual fixed point distributions for epsilon and j that come out at the critical point. And they are conveniently written in logarithmic variables. So zeta is a log of j, beta is a log of epsilon. And you see that these distributions take this form, where gamma, which is log of the energy scale of the RG, shows up here. So as the RG progresses, gamma becomes larger and larger, which means these distributions, even on a log scale, become broader and broader. Right? So as we go down in energy, the distributions of the couplings become broader and broader, therefore justifying the method. Right? Remember, we started from the idea that we have broad distributions, so we can apply local perturbation theory. And here, we now see that the distributions indeed become broad under RG. In particular, it may be interesting to in the context of this workshop, it may be interesting to translate this back to the distribution of the epsilons. And what you find is that right at criticality, in this case, you get a structure, P of epsilon, that is 1 over epsilon times log of 1 over epsilon. So you get an extremely broad distribution of energy scales. Without the logarithmic correction, it would not be integrable. So this makes it integrable. And interestingly, it takes the same form as you discussed, except for the log, as you discussed. And so therefore, what one can expect is if one asks about non-equilibrium phenomena, just based on this distribution, one can expect very similar non-equilibrium phenomena than in this case. But this is just a side remark. We have not really worked on that yet. OK, so these are the fixed points. Let's talk a little bit about the consequences for the thermodynamics. So the critical point that emerges, and now we just borrow results from Daniel Fisher, right, is a very unusual critical point. It comes with the name infinite randomness critical point, and the reason is that the distributions of the couplings become infinitely broad. And the most striking consequence is that there's a logarithmic relation between length and energy scales, right? So here you see that the log of the energy scale scales like a power of the length, this has to be contrasted with a usual dynamical scaling at the critical point, where the energy scale itself scales like a power of the critical of the length. All the rest of the critical behavior is also known. The correlation exponent is known, and it's known how the cluster size scales with decreasing energy. And all these are asymptotically exact results, again, because this procedure becomes exact in the limit of infinitely broad distributions. Okay. Then, as I've already pointed out, close to the critical point, there are these Griffith regions. Yeah, we have large clusters of the wrong phase embedded in the embedded in the bulk phase. And another consequence of this logarithmic relation between energies and lengths is the fact that the phase boundary, and coming down here, for a transition that has a real ordered phase at zero temperature, would take such an exponential form. Okay, let me see. Let me very briefly talk about this. So if I wanted to calculate thermodynamic quantities within this method, that would be rather straightforward. So if I want to know a certain thermodynamic property at temperature T, right, then what I would do is take the realization group, run it down to an energy scale equal to temperature, and then it's clear that the remaining clusters, they will be coupled by couplings that are much, much weaker than the temperature, right, because of broad distributions again, right? The temperature is the cutoff, and all the remaining couplings would be much smaller than the cutoff. So the remaining clusters are effectively free. And so, for instance, if I wanted to calculate the order parameter susceptibility, so it's not the magnetic one in our case, it's the order parameter susceptibility, then I would just have to take the number of clusters, the size of the clusters, and combine all of that. And this gives me a logarithmic dependence on temperature. I can do the same thing in the Griffiths phase, so away from the critical point, but still within the regions where I have large spatial regions of the wrong phase embedded in the bulk phase, and then I get non-universal power laws for the order of susceptibility or other thermodynamic quantities, and the exponent characterizing this power actually changes continuously when you approach the actual critical point. Okay, let me skip this maybe. And let me also point out that the RG predictions have been confirmed numerically by Adrian Del Maestro. That was part of his thesis in Supersatchel's group in Harvard. So he solved the large N action that I wrote down a few slides before. He solved it numerically instead of using the RG procedure and calculated various quantities, correlation functions, the gap, and susceptibility ratios. And from this, he extracted exponents. And here are the numerical exponents compared to the theoretical predictions. And you see the agreement is very good. So this confirms that the large N action I wrote down indeed features such a critical point. Okay. All the explicit calculations I showed you were for the large N limit of the theory. And the question is what survives for finite N? And, whoops. In order to understand this, it's important to understand where the multiplicative structure of these recursion relations comes from. And remember, there are two recursion relations. One corresponded to just throwing out a site and calculating the new bond in perturbation theory. And this one is actually simple because the multiplicative structure, so the new J being JJ over epsilon, is strictly a result of second order perturbation theory. Right? You have epsilon downstairs and the two matrix elements upstairs. So this will not depend on details of the action. The other recursion relation is not so trivial. So this was a recursion relation that gave the new gap being epsilon over J, or correspondingly giving an exponential dependence of the gap and the cluster size, right? And so whenever we have this exponential dependence of the gap and the cluster size, then we will get the same structure of recursion, and then correspondingly the same flow equation at the same fixed point. But it's clear from Merwin-Waag theorem that this applies to all continuous symmetry cases, so all cases n larger than 1, because in all these cases, according to the simple-minded Merwin-Wagner argument from integrating the transverse fluctuations, you find that that the gap is exponential in the size or the coupling strength. And so this would be true in all of these cases, except modulo extra complications coming from topological defects in the case of XY symmetry in 1 plus 1 dimension. It's also clear that Ising order problems are different. I just point out in passing that there the disorder effects are even stronger. OK, so therefore, it's from this argument, I think it's understandable that this large n limit that we use to actually carry out the calculations will not change the result. OK, now in the last 5 minutes or so, let me go back to something that may be more easily measurable. And so as a first step, we calculated the contribution of the superconducting fluctuations to the conductivity. So this is the Cooper formula for the conductivity containing the current-current correlation function and the diamagnetic term. And if we calculate this within our theory, then we are calculating the contribution of the Aslamazov-Larkin fluctuations to this to the conductivity. And this can be done within the RG scheme very easily. You just have to include a coupling to the vector potential, and then include this coupling to the vector potential at each stage of the RG. So we could just continue, we normalize the term coupling to the vector potential. And then we can evaluate this at any stage of the RG to find the conductivity.
And what about Markey-Thompson?
Markey-Thompson and density of states corrections are, of course, there. But there is a paper by Nayana Shaw, and I don't remember who else, who showed that close to the close to criticality, the Aslamazov-Larkin are the dominating fluctuations. The others are there, but they are subleading. They did a microscopic calculation comparing the three. OK, so if you do this, then you find that at criticality, you find a logarithmic contribution in frequency to the conductivity, a contribution that goes like log over omega squared. And if you go away from criticality, then it obeys a scaling form that again reflects this activated character of the critical point. So it's a log of frequency that scales like a power of the distance from the critical point. And here are again numerical data confirming the scaling form. So these are the raw data showing a conductivity versus frequency for various distances from criticality. And here is the scaled form. We come to the scaling form. And you see they scale reasonably nicely. In particular, if you leave out the blue dots here, which are far away from the critical point, the relative distance of 0.68, which is outside of the critical region by any reasonable measure, all the remaining data scale very, very well. OK, maybe I skip this and just show the conclusions. And thank you for your attention.
So this gamma
term is acting also like a disordering field, right?
The gamma will also be random, of course, if all the other parameters are random. Yes. Yeah.
No, I mean, disordering in terms of, let's say, transverse is in one, the temperature is disordering field, or the transverse field is a disordering field in that sense.
It's the epsilon actually that plays the role of the transverse field in the transverse field chain.
Simply adding to that, so.
Yeah, and the gamma is slave to the epsilon. Well, you have to see that, of course, the linear frequency term is only the first term in an expansion, right? There will be an omega square term, and if I would put the gamma to zero, then I would recover the physics of a quantum rotor model, right? Which also can have a transition with different properties.
I would like to say another word, it cancels this in the Landau expansion. Very simple example. Consider two superconducting grains embedded in normal metal where this critical parameter is smaller than zero. Then Ginzburg-Landau gives you exponential with the distance between grain decay of critical current just because of Ginzburg-Landau. In fact, at zero temperature, this critical current decays either as 1 over r to the power 2 to the dimensionality of space in two dimensions, 1 over r squared, or if it's random magnetic field, it is e to the power minus square root of length. So it's a huge difference. And this huge difference is translated to all this RG. And that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.